So this lecture is a review on chapter 1 and chapter 2. Chapter 1 is the art and science of economic analysis, and chapter 2 is some tools of economic analysis. So let's get started here with this review. These chapters, by the way, make up the first test, which is, of course, chapters 1 and 2. So the first thing in chapter 1 here, looking at the slide, is what is economics? Economics is the study of how people choose to use their scarce resources in an attempt to satisfy their unlimited wants. So let me talk about this just for a minute. There's something called the economic problem. And the economic problem, which all societies face, is that we live in a world of scarce resources. And yet people have unlimited wants and needs. So how do we meet their needs in this world of scarcity? Now, no matter how far you go in economics, you could get a PhD in economics, but no matter what you study, the main theme is always this economic problem. The main problem is that we do live in a world of scarcity. So how do we meet people's wants in this world of scarcity? Now, different societies answer and attempt to solve this problem in different ways. And of course, in this course, what we do is we're looking at the American economy, and which is a mixed social economic system, and we're seeing exactly how we attempt to solve this problem. Now, we will never solve the problem entirely. The only way to solve the problem is that everyone could have everything they want, and that's simply not going to happen. But we can get closer to solving the problem. So let me pick apart this economic problem and this definition of economics. First of all, what assumption do we make? When looking at the economy, we assume that people behave in accordance to their own self-interest. This is something that Adam Smith, way back in 1776, used this term and use the term the invisible hand. The economic problem, or at least what he was trying to explain, is how is it that in a free enterprise system, when there's no central authority, that the system seems to produce exactly those goods and services that people want and need and at prices they can afford to pay. And he talks in his book, The Wealth of Nations, how people acting in accordance to their own self-interest, then the national interest is ultimately satisfied. Now, self-interest here sounds like a sort of a selfish thing. Well, you know, like everyone's out for themselves and inward-looking, but actually it's the opposite. What we mean here by self-interest is that in a free enterprise system, in order to get more of what you want, you have to help other people get what they want first. And so you have to get your mind off yourself and onto other people, because only when you meet their needs can your needs be met. And you might look at it as a business owner, and in order to sell to people, you have to provide them what they want at prices they can afford to pay. And if you can't meet their needs, then they're not going to buy from you, and therefore your needs will not be met. So this is basically, the fundamental premise of a free market economic system. So what is macroeconomics, and then what is microeconomics? Well, this semester we cover what is called macroeconomics. Now, economics is divided into macro and micro. The first semester here at New River is always macro. The second semester is micro. The two make up what is called the principles of economics. So macroeconomics is the study of the economic behavior of entire economies. In macroeconomics, it's just like you're flying over the economy in an airplane, and you're looking down, and you're seeing how everything fits together. So we study things like inflation, unemployment, money in banking, those things that you might read about every day in the newspaper is what we study in macroeconomics. Microeconomics, micro is a Greek word meaning small, is a study of the economic behavior in particular markets, such as the market for computers. Now, basically what microeconomics involves is the decision-making process of economics. What is the thought process of a person who is going to make decisions to try to maximize their welfare? Or how does a business owner make decisions to decide what to produce to maximize the profit, or what price to charge, or what quantity to produce? So microeconomics, the bulk of it involves this decision-making process of economics. So now what we have in this chapter and basically the next chapter is a lot of definitions. This is just the beginning. We're just getting started here. This is the first step of a long journey that will take us over two semesters. And so you've got to view economics here as kind of like a foreign language. Indeed, you can buy a dictionary that's got nothing but economic terms in it. So a good part of what we do here, especially in these early chapters, is that we just dwell on the vocabulary. And then we talk about certain concepts. And it's not till later in the course where we actually use these concepts and our familiarity with the vocabulary to explain certain economic phenomena. Now, I may explain certain economic phenomena here early on, but only for reasons of example. But the bulk of what we do here at the beginning is just introduce certain terms and certain very basic concepts. So one term that we use here a lot in economics is a good. What is a good? A good is a tangible item that is used to satisfy wants. There are goods and there are services. We, as consumers, we may buy a good or we might buy a service. A good is something tangible. A service is something intangible, like when you pay someone to do your taxes or you pay someone to give you a haircut. That's a service. Okay, so what is a free good or service? A free good or service is when there is enough of a good or service to go around for everyone who wants it for free. Now, there are free goods and there are scarce goods. A free good means like it's water from a drinking fountain, okay? You go get water, you don't, drink as much as you want, you don't have to pay for it. How come? Well, because there's enough of that water coming out of the water fountain that's, for everyone who wants it at a zero price. Now, what is a scarce good? Well, a scarce good is when there's not enough of something to go around for everyone who wants it at a zero price. So if there's not enough of something to go around for everyone who wants it for a zero price, then in a free market, how do we decide who gets and who doesn't get? And the answer to that question is prices. This is the reason why different goods and services have prices in our economy, to decide peacefully, okay, we don't have enough for everyone here, and so we're going to put a price on it. At least the market's going to dictate a price, and the market therefore will decide who gets and who doesn't get. Of course, in this free market, who gets? Well, it takes two things to get. First of all, you've got to have the money, and second of all, you have to have the want to. So every good or service that you see in our economy that has a price is by definition, therefore, scarce. If it weren't scarce, it would not have a price. Now, the more scarce it is, of course, the higher the price will be. And this is how we decide who gets and who doesn't get when there's not enough for everyone who wants it at zero price. Those who get are the money and have the money and those who want it the most. Okay, so we're still talking here about this definition of economics, or talking about the economic problem. Again, let me reiterate the economic problem. We live in a world of scarce. Now, I just defined the word scarce for you. It's not as a lot of people think. You know, it doesn't mean rare or hard to come by. Scarce means, we don't have enough of this good or service to run for everyone who wants it at a zero price. That's what we mean by scarce. So, again, the economic problem is we live in a world of scarce resources. All right, now what I'm going to do is I'm going to define what resources are. Now, there are four types of resources. There's land, labor, capital, and in a free market, entrepreneurship. And everything that we have, the tangible things that we produce are made from these resources. So I'm going to define for you each one here. First of all, what is a land resource? Well, a land resource is anything from the earth. Fresh water, arable, farmland, iron ore, different type of minerals, uranium, gold, silver, anything that is natural from the earth, timber, these things are called a land resource. So what is labor? Labor is the second resource that we look at. Now, labor, we define what labor is. Labor is directed energy. It's it could be skilled labor or unskilled labor. It could be physical labor or mental labor. But when we talk about labor, we're talking about exerted energy that is directed at trying to solve the economic problem. Okay? Labor is mental or physical, skilled or unskilled effort when that person is involved in something to try to, in our attempts to solve the economic problem. So, what is capital? Capital are the machines and tools used in the productive process. Machines and tools used in a productive process. Again, let me give you an example. Let's say a hammer in the hands of a carpenter would be an example of capital. A hammer that you might have at your house, at home, is not an example of capital. Okay, so what's the difference? I mean, we're talking here about two hammers. They might even be identical, and one's capital and the other is not. Well, it's not the hammer as much as it is how the hammer is used. If you have a machine or tool that is used in our attempts to solve the economic problem, it's used in a marketable way, then by definition we call that capital. If it's not used, like for example, I have a truck and drive back and forth to school, and I get up wood in it and mulch, and I help people move. You find out how popular you are when you got a truck. But that, my truck is not an example of capital because I'm not using it in a business sense. I'm not using it in our attempts to solve the economic problem, and I'm not paid money by people who hire my truck out. So my truck is not an example of capital. Now, if you give my truck to a builder, for example, and that builder is involved in he's being paid, people are paying him to build a house, for example, then that truck would be an example of capital. Okay, so we've talked about the three resources so far: land, labor, and capital. The fourth resource is entrepreneurship. Now, what is entrepreneurship? Entrepreneurship is the managerial and organizational skills combined with the willingness to take risks. More specifically, the entrepreneur is a particular kind of person. The entrepreneur is a person who sees opportunity sometimes when other people don't see it. He's able to combine resource in a productive way. and he's able to start and grow a business. All entrepreneurs are business people, but not all business people are entrepreneurs. An entrepreneur is a special kind of business person. The entrepreneur is the driving force, behind the business endeavor. You can have a president of a company, but that doesn't mean that person is an entrepreneur. That person simply may be a manager, just simply running the business. But an entrepreneur is that special kind. The entrepreneur it gives the spark and vitality to the economic system. He's an original thinker. He's willing to take risks. He's willing to dream, to have a vision, and to make that vision into a reality. It's a very special kind of person. Now, all of you that are listening to this tape are the fact that you're involved in this course and you're listening to these MP3 files on these lectures. You are already demonstrating certain characteristics of an entrepreneur. Like, what kind of characteristics? Well, like you're paying money and you're putting in time to get an education, but there's no guarantee that this time and money will ever really benefit you. I mean, maybe you'd be better off not to go to college at all in terms of making money. Now, you know, and I know that there's a high probability, very high probability that you're going to get not only your time and money back, but you're going to get back many times over, and that it will be worth your while in many aspects, the fact that you're in college. But the point is that you have a dream, or you wouldn't be here. You're looking ahead. You're looking into the future. You have a purpose. You've learned the lesson of delayed gratification. You say, I want something better for myself, and I'm going to work hard right now. I'm going to put money in. I'm going to put my time in. And someday this will all benefit me in terms of a better life. Well, the fact that you think that way, is one of the characteristics of entrepreneurship. Okay, so let me move along here. I'm looking over these slides. Again, this is just a quick review of the first two chapters, so I can't spend a whole lot of time. Now, if you want a lecture in more detail, you can listen to my actual lecture MP3 files. I have an MP3 file of all my lectures for the whole semester available to you, and some of the chapters that we cover, will take either two or three lectures, and so for one chapter you might have as many as six lectures, which would be, six times 50 minutes, where what I'm doing here is just giving you an overview, just hitting the highlights in 50 minutes of the first two chapters. Okay, so let's just continue on with some of the vocabulary here. What is a market? A market is a set of arrangements through which buyers and sellers carry out exchange at mutually agreeable terms. A market is some place where buyers and sellers can come together and enter into some kind of transaction. The reason why this is important and we emphasize it here is that in economics, if it's not occurring at the market, then we're not concerned about it. For example, if we were to come up with a fertility drug and double the birth rate of cows, would that increase the supply of cows? And the answer is, well, not necessarily. How come? Well, because in economics, we're not concerned about how many cows we have staying in 4 feet. What we're interested in is what is happening at the market. Now, as a result of the fertility drug, if more farmers brought more cows to market, then the supply of cows would increase in the market. Or as we would simply say, the supply of cows increases. See, that the point here is that that economics is the study of markets, and if it's not occurring at the market, then we're not really concerned about it in our study of economics. So there are all kinds of different types of markets. You know, the stock market is a place where stocks are bought and sold. You know, a supermarket is a place where food is bought and sold. And of course within there we have vegetable markets, and we have there's markets for every good and service that can be bought and sold. Okay. I'm looking over these slides here. There are two types of markets, by the way. There's a product market and there's a resource market. A product market is a market in which goods and services are exchanged. And when you're thinking of markets, it's the product market that you would normally, think about. But there's also something called a resource market, and a resource market is a market where resources, land, labor, and capital, are exchanged. Now, you might not think that, you were ever involved in a resource market, but one way that most of you are involved in a resource market is when you have a job. See, when you have a job, what you're essentially doing is that you're selling your labor to your employer. And the labor is a resource. So in this market, when you're looking for a job, you are part of the resource market, and you are the supplier where the business who might hire you is the one who is doing the demanding. And in this aspect, you are involved in the resource market. Okay, well, moving ahead now, what does the term marginal mean? The term margin means it's a term used to describe the result of a change in an economic variable. Now, this sounds very innocent, but margin, of economics involves what's called marginal analysis. And we can describe certain behavior by using marginal analysis. Now, marginal analysis we're considering in marginal analysis only the last unit. Now, very quickly, I'll give you an example of how we use marginal analysis. Let's say that you want to buy a soda pop. And you're standing in front of a soda pop machine, and a soda pop is a dollar, and you're kind of thirsty, and you have several dollars in your pocket. So the question is, are you going to buy a soda pop? And maybe how many soda pops are you going to buy? Well, economists can answer this question very definitively, and what they would say is, in order to know how many soda pops you're going to buy, we always have to start at the beginning and take one unit at a time. And so we start with the first soda pop. And we say, okay, will you or will you not buy the first soda pop? And the answer is, yes, you will, if your marginal utility is greater than the price. Now, what does marginal utility mean? Well, the word margin means the last unit. Utility is a measurement of a level of satisfaction, like, 10 utils is twice as many as 5 utils. You're standing in front of a soda pop machine. Now, the point here is that if you place a greater value on the first soda pop, one soda pop, than you do a dollar, then you'll be willing to give up a dollar in exchange for the soda pop, because you're willing to give up something of lower value to receive something of higher value. So let's say you do this. You say, okay, I'm kind of thirsty. I got some dollars. I want a soda pop. I put more value on the soda pop than I do a dollar. So you put a dollar in the machine and you get a soda pop. Why did you do that? Because your marginal utility was greater than the price, meaning that you place a greater value in the soda pop than you did the dollar, which is the price. Then the question is, okay, will you buy a second soda pop? And the answer is, yes, you will, if marginal utility is greater than the price. Well, will you buy a third soda pop? Well, yes, you will, if marginal utility is greater than the price. So how long are you going to buy additional soda pops? Well, you'll buy additional soda pops as long as your marginal utility is greater than the price. Now, keep in mind here that when we say marginal utility, we're only considering the very last unit. We're not considering the first, all units, or we're not taking an average or a total. We're only looking at the last unit, because that's when you're making decisions, that's the only thing that's germane, is the last unit. And so if we ask a question, well, how many soda pops are you going to buy? Well, the answer would be you'll continue buying soda pops as long as your marginal utility is greater than the price. Now, at that soda pop, that one unit, where your marginal utility is less than the price, then you will not buy that last soda pop. So that's how economists answer questions in terms of why people behave as they do, and how many units of something they're going to buy. We always use what is called this marginal analysis, something. It's used a whole lot in economics. Okay, there's something here called normative economics and positive economics. Normative economics is a statement that represents an opinion which cannot be proved or disproved. Normative economics involves someone's opinion of something. Whereas positive economics is a statement that can be proved or disproved by reference to facts. And the point here is that in economics, we always dwell on positive economics. We don't give our opinion of how we think things should work, but we dwell on what is called positive economics. Okay, so this completes the first chapter. It doesn't complete everything in the first chapter, but it's a fairly good overview of the first chapter. So I'm going to move on now to the second chapter, and chapter two is called Some Tools of Economic Analysis. And again, what we're doing in chapter two is that we're looking at some definitions and, a few concepts. Like, last chapter we looked at the concept of marginal analysis. Okay, so what is the first definition? First definition is something called opportunity cost. Now, what is opportunity cost? Opportunity cost is the value of the best alternative foregone when an item or activity is chosen. So the point here is that every time you make a decision, you incur what is called an opportunity cost. That opportunity cost, as a result of any decision you make, is that thing that you give up in the best alternative. So all decisions entail an opportunity cost. Now, when we look at opportunity costs, we're not saying that one decision is better than another. All we're saying here is that if you decide to do one thing, then you can't do something else at the same time. For example, what is your opportunity cost of attending college? Well, your opportunity cost of attending college is that, in terms of money, is that income that you have given up because maybe you can't work full-time. Or even if you're working full-time, maybe you can't work at a job that would have paid you more if it weren't for your school schedule. Now, especially if you're a full-time student, most students I know are incurring fairly large opportunity costs. And that opportunity cost is just, you know, part of your education. For example, if you're making $300 a week right now with your school schedule, but if it weren't for your school schedule, you could work at a different job, or you could work more hours doing what you're doing, and you could make $500 a week, then your opportunity cost of attending a school is $200. That's what you're giving up. You're saying, okay, you know, I can't make $500, you know, and work as many hours because of my school schedule, so I'll work fewer hours, and so I'm going to give up that $200. So that $200 is opportunity cost. Take a another example would be a city. A city's got, you know, X number of dollars to spend, and they can say, well, you know, we need a new park, and we also need to hire an additional policeman, but we don't have enough money to do both. So if they put the money to hire an additional policeman, then the opportunity cost is the park that did not get built. You know, the opportunity cost is the pleasure of the you know, the citizens, and you know, not having this park. But if we spent money on the park, then our opportunity cost would be you know, one less policeman. Now, which is the best decision? Well, you know, we're not saying one decision is better than the other. We're simply saying that, well, if you choose a park, you can't have the policeman. If you choose a policeman, then you can't have the park. And you know, every decision involves an opportunity cost. Now, opportunity cost may differ depending upon the situation, even for the same person, even for the same activity. For example, let's say that your room at home, you know, your bedroom, let's say, needs cleaning, you know, straightening up and just, you know, a good, you know, cleaning. And let's say that you really like to golf, and it's a beautiful day outside, you know, it's balmy, it's 75 degrees, sunny sky, and I mean, just a perfect day to go golfing. Now, what is your opportunity cost of cleaning your room? Well, the opportunity cost is very high. Boy, you know, I mean, here I am in this house and in doing this cleaning, and I would much rather be outside playing golf. So, you know, you've got a high opportunity cost here. Now, what would happen though if it's real cold outside and you know, even sleeting and rainy and cold and damp, and your room needs cleaning? Well, what's your opportunity cost, you know, stay indoors and clean your room? Well, it's much lower now because, well, you couldn't go golfing anyway. At least it wouldn't be much fun golfing in the cold and rain and sleet and all that. So here, you know, I mean, you're the same person, golf is the same game, the room is the same, but yet your opportunity cost is different on different days depending upon the circumstance. Okay, so moving on here, what is absolute advantage? Here's another concept, a term, and keep in mind here, you know, what this chapter is all about. The name of this chapter is Some Tools of Economic Analysis. In other words, like with opportunity costs, you know, that's a tool that we use to explain certain economic phenomena. And same with, you know, these other things that, you know, these terms that we're going to learn, you know, can be tools used to explain how the world works, so to speak. Okay, so what is absolute advantage? Here's another tool, which involves another definition. Absolute advantage is the ability to produce something with fewer resources than other producers use. So you have an absolute advantage in something if over another person, if you can do that something better or faster than someone else. See, that's, you know, absolutely you have the advantage. You know, for example, if you can paint a room in 2 hours and a high school student takes 3 hours to paint the room, then you have an absolute advantage in painting the room. See, you can do something, you know, better and faster than someone else. So compared to that someone else, you have an absolute advantage. Now, but there's something else called comparative advantage. Now, comparative advantage says that it involves the ability to produce something at lower opportunity costs than other producers face. So if you have a comparative advantage in something, that means that you can do this something with lower opportunity costs than someone else. Now, let me give you an example of how we use absolute advantage and comparative advantage. True or false, if America is to maximize its welfare, it should produce those things that it is best at producing. And the answer to that question is false. We would not necessarily maximize our utility if we produce those things that we are best at producing. By so doing, we would be producing those things that we have an absolute advantage in. But as I'm going to show you, I'm going to give you here just a very brief example that would not necessarily, lead to maximizing our utility. Which is utility, again, as you recall, is a way of measuring the level of satisfaction. So, for example, let's say Americans were better than anyone else making handmade wicker baskets. So we have an absolute advantage in making handmade wicker baskets. I mean, why we Americans can do this better than anyone else, no one knows. But for some reason, we just have a knack for it, and no one in the world can do it better than we can. So does that mean that we ought to devote our time and energy to making handmade wicker baskets? And the answer is, well, no. Why? Well, because America is an advanced industrial nation, with a great deal of technology. And if we were to devote our time and resources to making handmade wicker baskets, then that's the same time that we could not devote to other things, like computers. The high-tech field area. And therefore, our opportunity costs would be very high. See, if we were to devote our time and energy to making handmade wicker baskets, then our opportunity costs would be that time and energy that we would not be involved in, let's say, with computers. So we would say here that we may have an absolute advantage in making handmade wicker baskets, but we don't have a comparative advantage. Why? Because other nations maybe could make wicker baskets, like take a small developing nation and they could make handmade wicker baskets. Well, maybe they can't do as good as we can, but they can do an all right job. And their opportunity costs would be very low. I mean, they don't have a high level of education. They don't have the infrastructure that we do. They don't, have the advanced economy that we do. So making these handmade wicker baskets may be one of the few things they can do. So when they devote their time and energy to making these handmade wicker baskets, their opportunity cost is very low. And so we would say in this example that they have a comparative advantage in making these handmade wicker baskets. Now, we might have an absolute advantage, but we do not have a comparative advantage in making wicker baskets. So it would be better for us to devote our time and energy to making things that we have a comparative advantage in, where our opportunity costs are low. Let them, this other developing nation, let them make the handmade wicker baskets and then trade. And so by doing, we both can increase our growth and our grow our economies. So the point here is that if you want to maximize your station in life, you should make decisions based on comparative advantage and not absolute advantage. You ought to devote your time and energy to those things that you have low opportunity cost in. For example, let's say your room at home needs painting, and the question is, well, should you paint it yourself or hire someone? Now, in terms of dollars and cents, this is how an economist would answer that. They would say, well, okay, let's say that you are a professional, and The average professional in this area here of New River Valley makes about $50 an hour. So if you were to take your time and paint the room, and that's an hour that you could, you know, as a professional, you could do something, you know, what your profession is and make $50 an hour, then your opportunity cost is $50 an hour. I mean, let's say you're an accountant. Well, you can't be doing someone's taxes and paint the room at the same time. So if you say, well, I'm going to paint my room, well, how much, you know, every hour, how much are you giving up? Well, you're giving up $50. Now, let's say you can hire someone to paint the room at $10 an hour. Well, now what's the case? Well, it's better for you. You see, you may have an absolute advantage in painting your room because maybe you can do it better than anyone else, but you don't have a comparative advantage if you can hire someone to do the room for $10 an hour, because you can hire them, they can do it for $10 an hour, you work during that hour, you make $50, you give them 10, they're better off 10, you keep 40, you're better off $40, and so you both gain. Now, if the room can be painted good enough, then financially it's better for you to hire someone to do it. Well, what happens, though, if you, again, you know, maybe to hire someone to paint the room is $10, but the most you can make is $7 an hour. Well, now should you paint the room or hire someone? Well, now in this case, you see, you should paint the room yourself because your opportunity cost is very low. Well, if you paint the room, how much are you giving up? You're giving up $7. I mean, if it takes you, you know, for every hour involved with painting the room, you're giving up $7 because that's how much you make an hour. And it would cost you $10 to hire someone, so you're better off to paint the room yourself. So this is how we use, you know, the concept of comparative advantage to make certain decisions. And in economics, we want to make wise decisions. Okay, the next concept here is the concept of specialization. And what is the specialization of labor? The specialization of labor is focusing an individual's efforts on a particular product or a single task. So how does the specialization of labor increase productivity? Now, when we say to increase productivity, that means that we can produce more units per time period at a lower per unit cost. If we can do more at a lower cost, then we've increased productivity. And what we look at here in economics is, and one fact that we learn is that when we divide up the labor, I mean, you know, instead of, you know, one person doing, you know, multiple tasks, if we have several people doing that task, but we divide it up into several bits and pieces, then we can increase productivity. And this is essentially what the assembly line is all about. You know, many producers, businesses use the assembly line techniques of production because by dividing up the labor by an assembly line, well, we increase productivity in several ways. One main way is by dividing up the labor, we eliminate non-productive activity, as opposed to what is called the skilled craftsman technique, where a person would, you know, do multiple tasks, but, few people would do multiple tasks instead of a lot of people doing just, you know, one single task. Another advantage with dividing up the labor is that it takes advantage of the individual's natural abilities. It also allows workers to develop more experience at a particular task. It permits the introduction of labor-saving machinery. So there's all kinds of reasons that we'll spend more time on. We've got a whole chapter coming up here just on productivity, and we're going to spend a lot of time, you know, exploring, you know, exactly, you know, why dividing up the labor, called the division of labor, leads to an increase in productivity, and then what that means in terms of economic growth. you know, in much, much more detail later on. But right now, we're just, you know, like skipping, you know, it's just like, you know, you take a pebble and you skip it along a steel pond, and well, we're just skipping along the surface here. We're just, you know, all these concepts that we're talking about here in this second chapter, we'll, you know, we'll talk about in much more detail later on. So, what is the production possibilities frontier? This is a picture that is used in the book called a production possibilities curve. And what economists like to do is that they like to draw pictures. You know, they say, well, now I've explained it to you, but you know, in order to make it really clear what I'm saying, let me draw you a picture. So that's really what the production possibilities curve is all about. It's a picture of the economic problem is essentially what it is. In other words, you know, we've talked about the economic problem. You know, that we live in a world of scarce resources, and yet people have all living at wants and needs. So, how do we meet their needs in this world of scarcity? And we talked about, you know, different concepts and different terms. And this picture called the production possibilities curve, it kind of illustrates a lot of these concepts that, you know, that we've talked about in terms of our attempts to solve the economic problem. So what the production possibilities curve is all about is that we have two sets of goods or services because it's a two-dimensional surface, and so we can only have two groups of goods or two goods. What we have in this book is we got consumer goods on the vertical axis and capital goods on the horizontal axis, and then on this we draw there's a curve, and what this curve tells us is how many units of each we can produce, and it shows us opportunity costs. In other words, if we're on the production possibilities curve, which means that we're operating at the most efficient level possible, then for us to have more capital goods, we would have to devote more time and energy and resources to capital goods, which means that we would have fewer consumer goods. So the consumer goods that we give up by devoting more time, energy, and resources to capital goods would be our opportunity cost. Where if we decide, okay, let's have more consumer goods. Let's you know, use our resources and put it toward more consumer goods. Well, then what's our opportunity cost? Our opportunity costs then are the capital goods that we have to give up. So this illustrates the fact that, you know, we're forced always to make decisions, and every time we make a decision, we incur an opportunity cost. Now, on this production possibilities curve, this is true, but now if we're operating within the production possibilities curve, where we're operating at a point of great inefficiency, you know, we're not using our resources as efficient as we could, then if we were to become more efficient, if we were to become, you know, wiser in how we use our resources, then we could have more of both consumer goods and capital goods. But that is only true up to a certain point. And those points is really on what the production possibilities curve illustrates. Now, this graph that I'm looking at, you know, shows a point beyond the curve, which says unattainable. Well, how come we can't go out there? Well, the reason is we don't have the resources to, you know, to have that combination of consumer goods and capital goods because we have limitations on ourselves. So maybe in the future when we have more resources or we increase productivity, we become more efficient, you know, we grow, you know, maybe we, you know, we could reach out, you know, to that point. But for now, the reason why it's called a production possibilities curve is that it shows the possibilities. See, that's, you know, those things that are possible given our present resources at this point in time. Okay, so moving on here, I've got about maybe 2 or 3 minutes. So let me very quickly, I can see the word end here. So we're not far from the end here of this chapter 2. What is an economic system? A set of social institutions and mechanisms organized to answer 3 economic questions. And what are the 3 questions? Who gets what and how much? Okay, the point here is that no matter what kind of economic system one lives under, every economic entity has to come up, has somehow, you know, they all wrangle with the same economic question. Who gets what and how much? Who gets, what do they get, and how much do they get? Now, there are different ways to answer this question. The two extremes would be pure capitalism and a command system. Now, pure capitalism would be an economic system characterized by private ownership of resources and the use of prices to coordinate economic activity in unregulated markets. Now, that's a formal definition of pure capitalism. A command economy would be an economic system characterized by public ownership of resources and centralized economic planning, where some central authority, which would normally be, the government, would make decisions of, what to produce, how to produce, and then decide who gets what and how much. Now, in the world today, there are no examples of pure capitalism, and there are no, there may be a few examples of a command economy. North Korea comes to mind, Cuba, and a few others are moving in that direction. Venezuela, is moving in that direction. These are the two extremes. Now, what we have in our country here in the United States is what is called a mixed capitalistic economy, which is an economic system characterized by private ownership of some resources and public ownership of others. Some markets are regulated and others are not. Now, in future chapters, we're going to be more specific here and looking at exactly, what kind of system we have in America and what is a mixed capitalistic economy. I mean, what things are, are characterized by private ownership and what things and why are some resources publicly owned. That takes us into more detail in a later chapter. So we have in this country what's called a mixed capitalistic economy. It's got some aspects of a pure capitalism and some aspects of a command economy. So this takes us to the end of Chapter 2, and this completes this review, this one lecture, 50-minute review on Chapters 1 and 2.